Today's Tuesday, September 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hurricane Dorian continues to hover over the Bahamas, delivering a devastating blow.
From all accounts, we have received catastrophic damage.
Dozens are missing and presumed dead after a diving boat they were on quickly went up in flames while they slept. Also ahead, Afrobeats are taking over international airwaves. It's all on today's International Edition. Hurricane Dorian unleashed massive flooding across the Bahamas on Monday, pummeling the islands with so much wind and water that authorities urged people to find flotation devices and grab hammers to break out of their attics if necessary. At least five people are confirmed dead, and sadly, that number is likely to rise. Prime Minister Hubert Minnis noting that they are in the midst of a historic tragedy and says the Abaco Islands have been devastated.
The initial reports from Abaco is that the devastation is unprecedented and extensive. They are deeply worrying. The images and videos we are seeing are heartbreaking. Many homes, businesses, and other buildings have been completely or partially destroyed.
Bahamas Foreign Minister Darren Henfield is warning residents not to go outside.
It is not safe to go outdoors. Power lines are down. Lampposts are down, trees are across the street. It is very dangerous to be outdoors if you don't have to be outdoors.
The fearsome Category 4 storm slowed almost to a standstill as it shredded roofs, hurled cars, and forced even rescue crews to take shelter until the onslaught passed. A local radio station received more than 2,000 distress messages, including reports of a five-month-old baby stranded on a roof and a grandmother with six grandchildren who cut a hole in a roof to escape rising floodwaters. Forecasters warn that Dorian could generate a storm surge as high as 7 meters. Meanwhile, in the United States, millions of people in Florida are under mandatory evacuation orders as the National Hurricane Center extends watches and warnings across Florida and the Georgia coast. Forecasters expect Dorian to stay offshore, but caution that only a small deviation could be extremely dangerous. Earlier, I spoke to National Hurricane Center Andy Lotto late last night, actually asking how dangerous it is for a storm of this size to stay virtually stationary like this.
It's catastrophic for the Bahamas, the northwestern Bahamas in particular. Currently, it's over Grand Bahama Island. So they've been experiencing major hurricane conditions.
And how long do you expect that it will just sit there?
We are expecting it to sit there probably for much of tonight. It may start to drift a little bit, but generally speaking, it's going to move very little over the next 12 hours or so. Still Category 4 hurricane.
What are you anticipating at the latest models that you have looked at so far for what's next?
So based on the forecasted advisory we had previously sent out, we have by 12 hours, which would be at this point in time about 2 o'clock in the morning, we have a forecast to be 130 mile per hour hurricane, and then 24 hours 125 miles per hour, and that's going to stay consistent probably throughout that day.
And do you have a better idea now of where it possibly would be headed? Would it be staying offshore or probably at least hugging the coast of Florida?
The western portion of the cone does move along just along the coastline of East Florida, and the cone then possibly goes a little bit inland over the South Carolina, but the other end of the cone, the east end, remains well offshore. So any deviation to the current track, which is slightly offshore to the left, would move it onshore central or northern Florida or possibly Georgia, South Carolina. Any deviation to the right will let it remain well offshore.
When it's just offshore like that, is it still pretty dangerous to the coast?
Yes. Like we saw Hurricane Matthew a couple years ago, that system remained offshore offshore and caused quite a bit of storm surge damage along and other wind damage along the coastlines.
And what about when it gets up to the Carolinas? If it's moving inland, will it start to weaken?
We're expecting to be a slow weakening trend as it moves north and then northeast. It's still expected to be a hurricane as it passes either by or close to the coastlines of the Carolinas.
So if anything deviates as far as it being, say, it's 100 miles off the coast of Florida and it deviates from that and just veers closer by even a few miles or even 10 miles or so toward Florida, how much of a difference would that make?
Well, given the radius of winds, for example, the tropical storm force winds extend out to up to 150 miles and the hurricane force winds don't extend out as far as that, maybe approximately like 40 miles last time I looked. So let's say the center of the storm was forecast to be approximately 75 miles offshore 2 days from now. The average forecaster we have here is roughly 80 miles that far out in time. So it could easily deviate to the left in that scenario and get the hurricane force winds to the coastline, which is why there's hurricane warnings up at the coastline of much of central and northern Florida right now.
And would that be a significant difference as far as what sort of damage they might see? Or are they still threatened even with it just hugging the shore, the coast?
With it hugging the shore, there's still a storm surge threat and there's threat for tornadoes. There's threats for strong winds as well. Of course, you're not going to get the sustained hurricane force if it rains far enough offshore. So that'll help dictate exactly how strong sustained winds they get and how big of a storm surge they get. But there'll still be notable effects as the system moves by based on the current track.
How rare is it to see a storm like this, this intensity and just hovering, not moving?
We've seen storms stall out for periods of time. In my recollection, it's been a while since I've seen one stall for this strong for this long a period of time. As far as intensity, back when it was at 185 miles per hour sustained yesterday, it was the strongest on record for the northwestern Bahamas.
All right. That is hurricane specialist Andy Lato with the National Hurricane Center. The Red Cross is planning what it estimates to be some 60,000 people in Florida, Georgia, South and North Carolina to possibly be needing help. A fire raged through a boat carrying recreational scuba divers anchored near an island off the coast of southern coast of California Monday, leaving at least 8 people dead, with hope diminishing that any of the 26 still missing would be found alive. 5 crew members escaped by jumping off the boat and taking refuge on an inflatable raft. Santa Barbara County Sheriff Bill Brown says fire crews were unable to help the victims.
Crews were actively fighting the fire when the vessel began to sink at approximately 7:20 a.m. 39 souls were reported to be on board that vessel when it left Santa Barbara.
The boat ultimately sank. More on the story from AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
The fire broke out this morning aboard a 75-foot diving boat.
The vessel currently has a portion of the bow sticking out of the water.
Coast Guard Captain Monica Rochester says 5 people were rescued.
The crew was actually already awake and on the bridge, and they jumped off.
They were evacuated aboard a passing Good Samaritan boat. One of the crew suffered minor injuries. The fire broke out about 20 feet offshore. 34 passengers were sleeping below deck. I'm Ed Donahue.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Taliban has made another attack in Kabul as the U.S. nears a peace deal. The weekend Texas gunman, who killed 7 people and wounded at least 20 more, was fired from his job and called the FBI before the shooting. Iraq suspends a U.S.-funded broadcaster after a corruption report. And many from Africa and Haiti are seeking asylum at the U.S. southern border. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will move to call an October 14th election if lawmakers block the option of leaving the European Union without a deal, according to a senior government source. Lawmakers are expected to vote on Tuesday on a plan that would give members of Parliament who are opposed to Johnson's Brexit strategy control over the parliamentary agenda. They would then seek to pass legislation to force him to ask for a further delay to Brexit. Joining us now from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, tensions are definitely running high. What's the latest?
The European Union actually put together a team several years ago that negotiated this so-called withdrawal agreement with then Prime Minister Theresa May. This team got together and went through little piece by little piece of all the negotiations, every agreement with the United Kingdom, and came up with this final withdrawal agreement, which, of course, Theresa May, then Prime Minister, couldn't get through Parliament. So then Boris Johnson came along and said to his own party, I can do a deal. I can get the European Union to change this agreement. I'm the man who can do this. Now, of course, what he forgot there or didn't mention was that the European Union has said, no, we are not reopening negotiations. They say that this withdrawal agreement protects the members of the European Union who are still members after Britain leaves. That's the bottom line. They have to look after the members' interests. If this agreement doesn't get through the British Parliament, then that's just too bad. That's the only deal on the table. If it doesn't go through and you still want to leave after all that, then you'll leave without an agreement. You will have to then go out of the European Union and trade with us as though you're a third country.
Time is definitely running short for some of those lawmakers who'd like to block a no-deal Brexit.
Time is short on the European side as well, because the French President Emmanuel Macron has been leading the group of the EU27 to say that the United Kingdom has to leave on the 31st of October. His line is that there is enough uncertainty in the world, there's the risk of an economic recession, that what the European Union needs to do is concentrate itself on its own economic and social problem. When they do buckle, it's usually something that involves an internal EU policy matter. It's never about something to do with protecting the integrity of the European Union. This idea that the British Prime Minister and other ministers are coming up with, saying that the EU will buckle at the last minute, they always do, does seem to be leading people down a false path, because the EU is pretty firm. It needs to stay together, and it will stay together, and they haven't given out any indication that it will lessen its negotiating stance so far.
So what are the state of negotiations?
Practically none. We had that big flurry on the 21st and 22nd of August when Prime Minister Boris Johnson came to Berlin to meet the German Chancellor, and then the next day he came to Paris to meet the French President. He was told very firmly that if they wanted a change to that withdrawal agreement, then he had to come up with proposals. Now, he's gone away. He hasn't come up with any new proposals. I spoke to an EU official last week. She said that last Thursday's meeting with the UK officials that were negotiating Brexit was a non-starter. They didn't have any new ideas. She said it was such a non-meeting, they didn't even produce a readout. They are still saying in Brussels at the European Union headquarters that there are still no new proposals being put forward by the British side.
It sounds like the backstop is what the EU chief Brexit negotiator says is their maximum amount of flexibility that they will offer to a non-member state. Is that pretty serious?
That is. Essentially, what they have said is the backstop, which would involve Northern Ireland retaining itself as a sort of a customs union with the European Union. That's the furthest they can go. He said, we go no further than that. We will keep the integrity of the single market. And if that means having a border through Ireland, well, that's what it's going to be, because they need to look after the member states. One of the other problems is that there is no real clarity coming out from the British Prime Minister. There are no new ideas, new proposals coming from London. So they're just saying, well, this is what we put forward. There's nothing new from our side.
What happens to all the citizens if there is no deal? How will that impact them?
If you're a British citizen living in the EU after Brexit, well, you will have to apply for residency status. And the EU countries have said, well, if you're already living in EU countries, if you've got a job and you're legally resident, yes, then you will get that. Likewise, if you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will have to apply for status as a resident, and that's what they're all doing. Among the other issues that will change are just enormous. For example, if you are coming over from the United Kingdom to Europe in your car, you will need to have new insurance, because up until then you were covered by European laws on insurance. It will even get down to the point that British people living in France who have got a British driver's license, that won't be valid anymore. It will also involve trucks that are carrying goods, your just-in-time deliveries. They won't be able to just drive through. You will have to have border checks for trucks coming in from Britain. Mm. They will have to look at what's in that. We'll have to see if it meets EU requirements on safety. One thing that they say they're sure of and they're ready for is that planes will be able to keep flying, because up until the UK leaves the European Union, they're covered by the European Union's agreement.
All right, that is Catherine Field reporting to us from Paris. Hong Kong saw more protests over the weekend, and today high school students gathered in a park on what was the first day of the new school year in a strike to show their continued support for the pro-democracy movement. International Edition's Steve Miller speaks with Hong Kong-based journalist Aaron Hale.
Aaron, I'd like to begin with, what can you tell us about the protests by the students today, which really was supposed to be their first day of school?
Yeah, so this is very similar to 2014, the start of the umbrella movement. Quite a few students are out on strike. That includes middle school students all the way through university. So this evening what we have is a very large rally going on at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, where students from all over the city have been bused in for a mass demonstration.
You mentioned that some of these students were very, very young. Are their parents there? What kind of dynamic is with them joining these protests?
Yeah, so we've actually seen students as young as 12 and 13 recently getting arrested, particularly in the last 2 weeks with petrol bombs. And I believe in one case, I think three of the students were actually taken away from their home. These kids, and they've been put in a care home until their trial proceeds. So it is creating a lot of sort of new legal ethical questions about it. But, you know, I've talked to a few of them, and they're like, my parents, they're either their parents don't know, or they say their parents support them.
Really quickly, can you give us any updates on the protests that took place this past weekend? Because we saw water cannons used and tear gas and other things used by the Hong Kong authorities.
Yeah, we had two very different events happen this weekend. The water cannon was deployed for the second time ever. They did use blue dye in it this time. That happened in the area outside of government headquarters, where there was a very intense protest underway. There were petrol bombs there, and then they moved the water cannon as the protesters retreated to another district, which is this big shopping district. The water cannon came along before everyone ultimately fled into the MTR system and they crossed the harbor. Yesterday was also a very odd and unprecedented day. Protests started at the airport, which currently has an injunction against protesters because of a large demonstration there 2 weeks ago. So that was on the outside of the airport this time, but they did still really managed to disrupt buses from coming in and the train from coming in. But as the police moved in, protesters ended up retreating from the airport. And some of them, because we're on Lantau Island, quite a few hundred people ended up actually making what was ultimately a 20-kilometer trek across this mountainous island to escape police. Mm. They walked on the highway and blocked traffic. Some people pulled off and got into buses along the way. And you also saw motorists picking up complete strangers and taking them to safety, because one thing we have seen as well is very, very rapidly increasing police presence. So that day, the police actually went to all the points of escape for them on Lantau Island and had riot police there and were doing ID checks. So no one felt they could get out through the normal train system or through the ferries. So they went into like individual people's cars two or three at a time, and then onto buses to completely random locations. So it was a very difficult and sort of odd weekend for Hong Kong, but I think one that showed that actually they do still have a lot of support from the public. Particularly yesterday, I felt like that people weren't that angry at them for occupying the highway. They actually were very helpful.
Speaking of police presence, these protests don't appear to show any signs of letting up anytime soon. How are people, you mentioned that there seems to be still a lot of support for the protesters, but this is 3 weeks now. Is there a growing concern of a more forceful crackdown?
I think there is a sense that we're sort of heading towards a precipice, but no one quite knows when that will happen or when we'll go over it, but I think we are going to start seeing regularly more police on the streets conducting stop and searches, particularly at train stations. And they're just going to be out and around more, and it'll be a bigger part of people's lives.
That's Hong Kong-based journalist Aaron Hale speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. African beats are spreading worldwide, due largely to a growing African population around the globe. But it is not just audiences from the diaspora that are dancing to the rhythm. As VOA's Jeshusman Oni reports, the international rise of Afro beats is causing a stir in the music industry and influencing culture and markets in the West.
Cause my papa no be done. Pop beats from Africa are reaching airwaves and set lists as far away as Washington, D.C.
My favorite song on there, that's the Follow You. Yeah.
Known as Afropop or Afrobeats, the music genre, once limited to African circles, has gained traction in the West.
It's been really great seeing artists that a lot of us know in Africa make it on New York radio or DC radio or a radio station in Iowa. And people actually gravitating towards it.
Afrobeats got a big boost in recent years from songs that feature transatlantic collaborations with American chart toppers like Chris Brown, Drake, and Rick Ross. But those artists shouldn't get all the credit for sparking interest in the music genre, says cultural architect Risakat Okede.
These folks, these artists, have always had their own following. So even if you are Burna Boy or, you know, Yemi Lade or something like that, and you're in Nigeria, there are Nigerians all over the world. So their music is always going to travel with the people.
Working with Billboard artists could mean a shot at global fame, says Cameroonian Afro pop star Salah Teal, who recently worked with Beyonce on the Lion King soundtrack.
Singing on the same song with Beyonce and Pharrell Williams, it means many more people are going to look, many more people are going to look onto Salah Teal, the artist, who is he, and how come he's on this album.
And as African artists seek to dominate new markets, it's a wake-up call that African countries need to beef up their own music industries.
I think our infrastructure needs to be tighter, like the whole African music industry in general. Like, royalties is not a thing. And I don't know how producers eat.
Means artists are taking their talents elsewhere. Several African acts have signed record deals with big American labels. Nigerian musician Iceberg Slim says that's because the world is craving an authentic taste of Africa.
We have to give them Africa, we have to give them Nigeria, we have to give them our culture. So it's definitely important that we stick to our sounds and stick to our cultures. And that's basically what we're selling them. This whole Afrobeats movement, we're just selling a culture.
And that business is booming, bringing in fans from far beyond Africa's borders. Jason Samaoni, VOA News, Washington.
Took a break and now she is back. Pop star Lindsay Lohan is making a musical comeback with the release of a brand new single. her first in 11 years. The song Xanax, the name of an anti-anxiety medication, talks about anxiety and pressure and taking care of yourself. Lohan teased the song on Instagram with a photo showing her dancing to parts of the song. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nick Ivanhoff. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the first Monday of September every year, the United States pauses to honor its workers and the contributions they make to our nation's prosperity. On September 5th, 1882, more than 10,000 men and women paraded through the streets of Manhattan to celebrate the first Labor Day. New York's Central Labor Union organized the day of celebration in honor of the workers who fought to secure higher wages, shorter hours, and better working conditions for laborers. It was a day of celebration, but also a day of sacrifice. The workers sacrificed that day's wages to demonstrate their commitment to gaining fair compensation for hard work. American workers transformed the United States and the world with a quality of life never seen in history. American farmers export more food than any country in the world and produce food more efficiently per capita than China and India, the world's largest food producers. The United States exports more refined petroleum than any other country in the world, and it exports more than 40% of the world's spacecraft and aircraft, and more than 11% of the world's electronics. America has the largest road network of any country in the world, with over 6.5 million kilometers of road. 90% of American households own at least one automobile, and American workers produce almost 3 million cars per year, nearly 5% of cars produced per year worldwide. A key element in America's economic success is the freedom that every American enjoys, the freedom to choose their work, the freedom to innovate and create new industries and revitalize old ones. "What we are witnessing today is the renewal of the American spirit," said President Donald Trump. "Our allies will find that America is once again ready to lead. All the nations of the world, friend or foe, will find that America is strong, America is proud, and America is free. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine," said President Trump. "We will shine as an example for everyone to follow."
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Hurricane